ॐ नमो ब्रह्मादिभ्यो ब्रह्मविद्यासम्प्रदायकर्तृभ्यो वंशर्षभ्यो महद्भ्यो नमो गुरुभ्यः नारायणं पद्मभुवं वसिष्ठं शक्तिं च तत्पुत्रपराशरं च व्यासं शुकं गौरपरं महान्तम् गोविंदयोगींद्रमथास्य शिष्यं श्रीशंकराचार्यमथास्य पद्मभारं च शस्त्रामलकं च शिष्यं तं धौतकं वर्तिककारमन्यान् अस्मद्गुरुं शुन्धतनुमानतोऽस्मि नमः श्रीशंकरानन्द गुरुपाराम्बुजन्मने सविलासमहामोह ग्राहक्रासैककर्मणे Very nice. We are coming towards the end of our text. Our current topic will conclude, I think, with several more verses. Current topic now is the destruction of ignorance and the fruits of that jnana, of that knowledge, the results of that knowledge. The destruction of ignorance giving rise to moksha. So obviously the destruction of other kinds of ignorance merely makes you more knowledgeable, right? So when you gain knowledge of computers or cooking or whatever, the ignorance that's destroyed doesn't bring you any great liberation. It makes you more knowledgeable. But this knowledge is unlike any other because this ignorance is unlike any other. This ignorance is not about cooking or computers. This ignorance is about you. It's about your true nature. And as we've analyzed at great length, this particular ignorance is the source of all human suffering. So when that ignorance is removed, it leads to complete freedom from suffering. The metaphor we've used for this so many times is that of the rope snake. When you mistake the rope for a snake, that ignorance gives rise to suffering. When that particular ignorance is destroyed, suffering goes away. That's our stock metaphor. One of the nice features of this of Vidyaranya's text is he likes using other metaphors in addition to the stock metaphor. Stock metaphors he uses, but he's a very creative writer and thinker. So he introduces to us some alternative metaphors for the gaining of knowledge, for the destruction of ignorance, and we're going to see that in the next two verses. We're going to see two unusual metaphors for the removal of ignorance. So we'll pick up the thread with the 236th verse. Mityabhi yoga doshasya Mityabhi yoga doshasya Prayaschittattva siddhaye Prayaschittattva Kshamapayan Kshamapayan hivatmanam Kshamatmayan hivat Sakshinam sharanam gataha Sakshinam sharanam gataha Mithya abhiyoga dosha. Suppose you falsely accuse someone of something. Suppose you go into the kitchen and some food is gone. And you say, you ate it. So this is accusation in Sanskrit is abhiyoga. But suppose he didn't eat it. Suppose somebody else ate it. So you've made a false accusation, a mithya abhiyoga. And to do so, to make a false accusation is wrong. It is a dosha. So that's our first compound, mithyabhiyoga doshasya. For a person who has committed this false accusation, What should they do? Prayaschittatva siddhaye, for the sake of prayaschitta. Many of you know that term and that tradition. And the idea is prayaschitta means, usually translated as expiatory act, expiation. Of course, you translate one confusing Sanskrit word with another confusing English word, it's not much help. Expiation means to an act of removing a sin, cleansing yourself of sin. Prayaschitta has that meaning. Prayaschitta karma is an act of removing a sin. So when you've committed this mithya abhiyoga, this false accusation, what should you do? Like any good Hindu, you should commit, you should do some kind of prayaschitta. I see this in especially in South India, this one. I like that. So what is the idea of it? You are actually making, you know, the idea of it is you are making your body undergo a difficult maneuver, and that causes some small pain, theoretically, to you. And that small pain is an act of prayaschitta. And in this way, kshamapayan, in this way you gain forgiveness for your false accusation. Now you might wonder, what in the world has this got to do with Vedanta for getting rid of ignorance? So here's a metaphor, and the commentator actually has to get into it a bit. Actually, there's a tikakara, the editor. The commentator didn't explain it so well, so then the editor goes on and explains this in some depth. And what he explains is that this false accusation represents your false superimposition. You falsely accuse stealing the food on someone. You falsely accuse Satchidananda Atma of being the one who suffers, of being the agent of action. Let's set this up a little Vedantically. You make a false accusation. Well, accusation here means superimposition. What is your false accusation? Suppose you put it in like a court documents. You accuse Mr. Atma of being the karta, agent of action. Not an agent of action. You accuse Atma of being bhokta, the one who is subject to suffering. That's a big one. So first of all, if you accuse Atma of being karta, then subject to reincarnation, no moksha. If you accuse Atma of being bhokta, subject to suffering. These are false accusations. Now, the consequence of these false accusations is you remain in a state of misery. So when you discover you've made a false accusation, going back to the food, going back to the drishtanta, the metaphor. In the metaphor, when you discover you've made a false accusation, what do? Prayaschitta. In this way, kshamapayan. In this way, you gain forgiveness. Doesn't really work so well in the metaphor. But the idea is when you discover you've made a mistake, you do something about it, right? You don't ignore the mistake. You correct the mistake in some way or the other. Here he talks of prayaschitta. We can conceive of it in other ways also. So if you make a mistake, you make whatever reparations are necessary when you've made that mistake. Certainly you want to make sure you never make that mistake again. Suppose you discover that you've made a mistake about Atma. You've made this false accusation on Atma, that Atma is the karta, agent of action. Atma is a bhokta, the one who is subject to suffering. Suppose you discover your mistake. What should you do? The metaphor, it's what would be equivalent to prayaschitta. What would be equivalent to prayaschitta? He says, eva, in the same way, atmanam sakshinam sharanam gataha. So when you discover you've made your mistake, what should you do? Gataha. You should go. Where should you go? Sharanam. You should go for refuge. This is the equivalent of the prayaschitta. Instead of prayaschitta is for a sinful act. This is for the act of wrongly accusing Atma of being the karta and bhokta. What should you do then? Sharanam gataha. You should go for refuge, is literally the term used here. Go for refuge where? Atmanam sakshinam. To the pure consciousness, Atma, which is sakshi, the witness of all mental activities. What is he saying? Is when you recognize you've made a mistake about Atma, you drop the mistake, and that Atma remains as your refuge. There's something subtle here. You know, some of you are wondering what is the import of this kind of weird metaphor. Here's the import: when you recognize your mistake, what is your recourse? Your recourse. In life, if you make a mistake, there might be some recompense involved. Suppose you're driving and you hit somebody's fender. So you're responsible for that, or through the means of insurance companies, you're responsible. One way or the other, you're responsible for making up for the damage. That's the idea. In modern times, if you do falsely accuse someone, what is your prayaschitta? Maybe or maybe not this thing, but definitely to go and apologize. So there's some act. When you've made a mistake, there's some act you must perform. That's the prayaschitta. That act you must perform to compensate for the mistake, to make up for the mistake in whatever way is appropriate. Now, you've made a mistake about Atma. You've made these false accusations about Atma for decades. For decades and decades, you've been making these false accusations about Atma. One day you discover, oh my God, I'm falsely accusing Atma of being karta and bhokta. Then what act should you do to compensate or make up for that false accusation? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. The solution is simply to drop the false accusation. Atmanam sakshinam sharanam gataha, and you remain as you truly are. You drop the false accusation, which means ignorance and its results are removed, and you remain as you are. There's a really important point here. The really important point is moksha is 100% removal of ignorance. Moksha is 0% acquisition of something new. You get it. Moksha is not the acquisition of anything new, nor is it the transformation. You're not taking an imperfect Atma and transforming it into a perfect Atma. You're not cleansing Atma. You're not recreating Atma. What are you doing? You're not doing anything to Atma. Atma is already Satchidananda. The only thing you accomplish is the removal of ignorance. And you say, well, is that it? Well, it is it, because that particular ignorance happens to be the cause for suffering. You get rid of that particular ignorance, you get rid of the suffering. That's a very big deal. What is in it for Atma? Nothing. What is in it for Chittabhasa, to use his language? Chittabhasa is where the suffering takes place. Your mind, your experience. Experience is transformed in such a way that worldly suffering comes to an end. So the so-called prayaschitta, when you discover your mistake, oh, I've been accusing Atma of being karta and bhokta for all these years. What is the solution? You simply drop the false accusation, you drop the wrong conclusions, and you remain as you've always been, but you remain without the suffering. That's the key. Okay, so this is the first of his two weird metaphors. The first one is like when you make a false accusation of someone. Let's see the second of the two weird metaphors. Yavaraje stito raja, yavaraje stitor putra samraja vanchaya, putra samraja van Rajanukari bhavati, Rajanukari bhavati, Rajanukari bhavati, Tatha sakshyanukaryayam, Tatha sakshyanukar. Another weird, he's, I shouldn't say weird, creative. It's like if somebody's showing, if somebody who's worked on some artwork and they share their artwork with you, what should you say? You don't, if it looks strange to you, you don't say it's weird. You say it's very creative. So what we see here is very creative, which means it's not standard Vedantic stuff, but it's creative. Nice to see something new for a change. So suppose in a kingdom there is the emperor, the samrat. Samrat is the emperor. And the emperor has a son. And the emperor's son is next in line to the throne. So to be next in line in the throne, the son would be called, the condition of being next in line is yauvarajya. Yuvaraja is the crowned prince, Yuvaraja. Yauvarajya is the state or condition. So, Yauvarajye stitaha Rajaputraha. Rajaputra, the son of the king, the son of the king, you leave emperor aside. The son of a king who is stitaha, established, who is made what? Yauvarajye, who is established as the next in line, the crown prince. So when the son of the king is anointed to be the next king, then what about that son? The son, samrajya vanchaya, has a vancha, means desire. Has a desire for what? Samrajya, to be king. So the king's son, having been anointed to become the next king, he's thinking, I really want to be the king. I can't wait to be the king. Of course, he doesn't want his father to die immediately, but he has that that sense of anticipation, looking forward to the day that he will be crowned king. But what does he do in the meanwhile? And this is the essence of the metaphor. So he is waiting for his father to die. Hopefully he's being a good obedient son while he's doing so. But as long as his father is alive, he is driven by this anticipation or desire to become the next king. So what does he do? Raja Anukari Bhavati. Anukari means one who imitates. Raja Anukari, he imitates his father. You know, his father walks around like this, you know, like the big shot king. So what does the son do? Starts walking around like that. The father wears a certain kind of robes. What does the son do? Wears those same kinds of robes. You know, we see this even in modern times. You see this little, you know, just to some extent. A complete aside. Occasionally I see in a spiritual group, I always find it very amusing when disciples end up looking just like their guru. That happens sometimes, and it's not wrong. You know, I think it's a matter of there's so much love and respect that they're driven somehow to physically resemble their gurus. So that's the same phenomenon here, right? That anukari, the one who imitates. Nothing wrong with it. In fact, that's a good thing. Hopefully the resemblance is not only external. We hope the resemblance is internal as well. And certainly that's the point of it. Okay. So this the son of the king is anointed to be the next king. And he's anticipating that date and wanting to become the next king. And what does he do? Raja Anukari Bhavati. He starts to imitate the king. Knowing that he will be king, he imitates the king. Tata. In the same way, knowing... Rajaputra represents, we have to get the metaphor straight, Rajaputra represents Chirabhasa, the mind and experience, the individual jiva also has that sense. So Chirabhasa is the one who for years and years and years has been suffering and struggling. And then one day this Chirabhasa figures out, hey, wait a minute. I'm Satchidananda. I'm not mere Chirabhasa. I am Satchidananda. So Chirabhasa recognizing, here it is in a kernel. Chirabhasa recognizing that it is truly Sakshi Atma, Satchidananda Atma. Chirabhasa recognizing its true nature as Atma. What does Chirabhasa start to do? Imitate Atma. Now, what does that mean? For Chirabhasa to imitate Atma. Chirabhasa means your experience. Your experience is also often full of suffering. Any suffering for Atma? So then for Chirabhasa to imitate Atma, it would mean to drop the suffering. Chirabhasa is limited and constantly changing. So if Chirabhasa wants to imitate Atma, what should Chirabhasa do? It should drop its sense of limitation and calm down. What it means, and to use other terminology, the mind conforms to the nature of Atma. That's the term anukari comes. It literally means imitates. Of course, to speak of the mind imitating is not very accurate, but we could certainly say the mind conforms. So just as the king's son imitates the king, in the same way, the mind conforms to the nature of Atma. The mind begins to enjoy the fullness and completeness that is the nature of Atma. The suffering falls away, the sense of limitation and incompleteness falls away, and the mind in that manner starts not imitate, but I think the good term here is the mind conforms. And to the degree the mind conforms, to that degree you enjoy fullness and freedom and completeness. We've discussed in a prior class the difference between jnana and jnana pala. Do you remember that discussion? Jnana means knowledge. Jnana pala is the fruits of that knowledge. And this is a very crucial distinction because we see in life many times we have jnana, we don't have the jnana pala. And the example I've given too many times is you have jnana that the sun doesn't travel through the sky. But you apparently don't have the jnana pala because you keep talking about the sun going down. In the same way, for most students of Vedanta, you get the jnana, but not necessarily the jnana pala. Which is to say, you make the discovery. You know that your true nature is that unchanging consciousness illumining all your mental activities. You get it. I think every one of you have gotten it. That is jnanam. If anything is missing, what is missing is jnana pala. And what is the nature of that jnana pala? It's when the mind abides in this knowledge, when the mind is firmly established in this knowledge, when the mind conforms to this knowledge. Just to bring it back to our verse. So as the son imitates the father, what we want is for the mind not to imitate Atma, but to conform in the sense of enjoying the reality that you are full, free, limitless, boundless, unborn, uncreated, unchanging, etc. To appreciate that, to abide in that knowledge. That's the jnana pala. And so here our rather unusual metaphor, the king's son emulating the king. In this way, we want the mind to abide or conform to the nature of Atma. So these are the two rather, we'll call them creative, don't call them weird, call them creative metaphors to describe the removal of ignorance. Now, we enter the last topic of this section. Last topic of this section is then what? So you've gained knowledge. Suppose you've not only gained the knowledge, but your mind is fully abiding in that knowledge. Suppose you not only have atma-jnana, knowledge of your true nature, but suppose you also have that abiding mind, that jnana-pala. We might use the term jnana-nishtha, being established in knowledge. Jnanam is step one. Jnana-nishtha, being established in knowledge, is step two. And for virtually every single student of Vedanta, these are clearly two different steps or levels. Almost. There might be a rare example of someone who goes right to the end. I've yet to meet such a person. I don't know if such a person theoretically exists. Practically speaking, I don't think so. So, suppose, what would it be like if you not only had jnana, but if you had jnana nishtha? What does it mean? Your mind completely abides in the fullness of your true nature at all times, in all situations. You're free from suffering. And then you stub your toe badly. You break the nail off. Your toe is now bleeding and throbbing. How to explain that? You know, moments ago, I thought you had jnana nishtha. You were full and complete. So you're full and complete. And imagine your toe is throbbing with such intensity. I hope you haven't had that experience, but the experience of blinding pain, where the pain is so intense, it just grabs your attention and you cannot put your attention on anything else because that pain is so absolutely intense. I've smashed my toe like that. I know. I know that pain very well. There's other pains that are equally nasty. I remember once passing a kidney stone. That was pretty good. So, and I think I have a feeling many of you who have given birth, you know that pain more than anyone else. Anyway, that's what we're talking about. That's blinding pain. So how can we reconcile these two? If you have this jnana nishtha absolutely established, and then how to explain the possibility of this blinding pain? Is it possible for an enlightened person not to experience that pain? So if the toe is bleeding and throbbing, The one who has jnana nishta doesn't feel it? Do you think, is that possible? Have their bodies become somehow numb? Silly, right? So let's examine this. In fact, there's a series of three verses. We examine this particular topic. Oh, introduction here. He goes back to the traditional metaphor. Here's the commentator. He says, Bhavatu raju sarpadi sthale viparita jnana nivrittau api tat karya kampanadi anuvrittihi. He begins this. He says, suppose you gain back to our stock example. What is a stock example? Rope snake. So he says, suppose you really get scared by that rope snake, but then your ignorance of the rope is removed. When the ignorance of the rope is removed, the snake goes away. But the commentator observes that there is anuvritti, and I want you to know that word, anuvritti. Anuvritti is a Sanskrit word for, I can't think of a better word, continuation. So he says there is anuvritti. After the snake goes away, something remains. There is anuvritti of something. The commentator says what remains is kampana. So you were so frightened by that snake, and then somebody says, come on, it's not a snake, it's a rope. Look, is it really? It's just a rope. Thank goodness it's just a rope. So the shaking continues for some time. If you've been so frightened, even after the fear goes away, I'm sure we could think of a better metaphor, but this is our stock metaphor. So after the snake goes away, there is anuvritti, continuation, in this case of the kampana, of the shaking, the trembling. And he introduces this next series of verses with that observation. And the verses begin.
Dashamopi shirastaram. Dashamopi shirastha rudan budhwanarodati shanai shamyati no tada.
So he goes, the verse leaves the rope snake aside, and we go back to our famous tenth man story, which we've seen earlier, right from the very beginning part of this chapter. Remember, we saw the tenth man story. And he explains here that the Dashamaha, the tenth man, when the tenth man thought that the tenth man was dead, that is, before gaining knowledge, what was the tenth man doing? Rudan was crying. Not only crying, but, you know, some different people handle sorrow in different ways. And somewhat cultural, you know, you see in Middle East, you see expressions like this and like this. You see these expressions. So I have a feeling in the time of the tenth man, what was a cultural expression of grief was to bang your head on something. So he was banging his head on a tree as an expression of grief. So not only Rudan, not only crying, but he was banging his head on a tree as an expression, as a culturally appropriate expression of his grief. And as a result, what happened? Shirastaram means beating your head, shiras, head. Taram, taranam, beating your head. So, dashamaha api, for that tenth man, rudan, while he was crying, and he was shiras taram, he was beating his head, but then buddhwa, having understood that the tenth man is not dead, in fact, having understood that he is the tenth man, having understood what happens, narodati, the crying goes away. You have to follow the essence of this verse. There are two things going on. Before he gained knowledge, there were two things going on. What was going on? Rodanam, crying, and shirastadanam, beating his head. So when he gained knowledge, narodati, he stopped crying. He also stopped beating his head, obviously. So he stopped crying and he stopped beating his head. But shirovranaha tu, but he stopped crying and he stopped beating his head, but there was anuvritti, continuation. Continuation of what? Shiras vrana. Vrana means wound. A wound to his head. If he goes on beating his head on a tree, you can imagine that he's now got some cuts on his forehead. And gaining knowledge, he stops crying, he stops beating his head. Does the wound stop? The wound is there. What can you do about the wound? Wound is, not only is the wound there, but masena, it takes a month, shanaihi, slowly, shamyati, navutada. Is it not so that the wound heals slowly over the course of a month or so? Now, this is it's very interesting metaphor. What is, this is the drishtanta, the metaphor. Now we have to see, what does the metaphor represent? That, notice that the crying and a beating of the head come to an end. The crying represents suffering. The suffering comes to an end. The shirastadanam, the beating of the head, represents karma. So karma done specifically in the darshtanta, in what the metaphor represents, beating the head, you won't like this. Beating your head represents going to work. What that means, going to work for the sake of happiness. That is, karma driven by raga dvesha. If you're going to work as a good karma yogi, no problem. If you're going to work because it's your dharma, it's your responsibility, no problem. But suppose you're going to work because you're really into your work, you want to climb up over it through the ranks, climb that corporate ladder, you want to earn lots and lots of money and buy lots and lots of toys. Suppose that's your orientation. That karma is represented by beating your head. That kind of going to work. And when you get knowledge that you are the tenth man, both the crying and the beating of your head go away. And when you get enlightened, suffering goes away and being driven to do karma for the sake of happiness and avoiding sadness goes away. Karma continues. But karma continues for the sake of dharma. Karma no longer, for an enlightened person, karma is no longer for the sake of gaining happiness and avoiding sadness. For an enlightened person, because there's no need. You're already full and complete. Why should you do karma for the sake of happiness and avoiding sadness? For the enlightened person, karma is done only out of a sense of dharma. So what happens for the enlightened person is suffering comes to an end, and that raga dvesha driven karma comes to an end. What doesn't come to an end, so the metaphor here is shiro vrana, the wound of the head. And what doesn't come to an end for an enlightened person are the consequences of prarabdha karma. We've had this discussion already. Remember, we had that threefold prarabdha, iccha, anicca, anyecha. And I don't want to return to the big topic. I don't think we need to return to it. But just very simply put, we know that when you get enlightened, the body continues to exist, the mind and senses continue to exist, and the body and mind exist because of certain prarabdha karmas. Remember the definition of prarabdha karma are those karmas which caused this particular birth. The karmas that gave rise to this particular birth, the karmas that caused you to be born to your parents at that time, at that place, the karmas also which contribute to the general shape of your life, in particular the karmas that determine the length of your life. According to the doctrine of karma, the length of your life is determined by prarabdha karma. You're born with so much karma, and you live until that amount of karma gets exhausted. When that amount of karma gets exhausted, your life has come to its natural end. This is the idea. Now, those karmas cause certain things in life. They cause us to stub our toes and causes bleeding, throbbing pain. Our prarabdha karmas cause us to undergo pain from passing a kidney stone or to undergo the pain of giving birth. Which is to say that prarabdha karma gives rise to various kinds of pain, and not just physical. If prarabdha karma can give rise to physical pain, then why not mental pain as well? The pain of losing a loved one would be a good example. So you have your prarabdha karma brings you into relationship with someone. That person passes away. You experience grief and loss. And that is born of prarabdha karma. So in life, various kinds of pain, both physical pain and non-physical pain, these pains are born of prarabdha karma, and that is identical for an enlightened person and an unenlightened person. Why? It's associated with the body and mind. Does enlightenment change your body? I mean, if enlightenment means light in the sense of weight, you wish maybe you lose a few pounds when you get enlightened. Sorry, that's a terrible joke, but I couldn't resist. So enlightenment doesn't change your body and doesn't change the fundamental nature of your mind. Which means if you had certain mental dispositions before you were enlightened, you're going to have those same mental dispositions after you're enlightened. If you like tea before you're enlightened, after enlightenment, you're not going to suddenly switch to coffee. It doesn't change anything. That's the point. So for an enlightened person, this prarabdha karma continues. Now, come back to the metaphor. So this poor fellow was banging his head, has a cut, and that cut is going to be on the forehead for some time. After a month or so, she says, shanaihi, slowly that cut will heal and the pain will go away. Similarly, for an enlightened person, slowly the prarabdha karmas will go away. Which means you're born with so much prarabdha karma. Every day you are exhausting this prarabdha karma. When these prarabdha karmas are gone, then this life will come to an end. And that's what he says. This is the metaphor here. So just as that wound which was caused by beating the head, that wound will heal slowly over the period of a month or so. In the same way, for the enlightened person, their prarabdha karmas will be gradually exhausted. Shanaihi shamyate, shamyati. Slowly. And that, by the way, that word is important. We don't want our after getting enlightened, do you want your prarabdha karmas to go over really quickly? Not necessarily, because if they go really quickly, then this life immediately comes to an end. So let it be shanaihi. Let it be slowly. Shanaihi shamyati. So slowly, gradually, the prarabdha karmas are exhausted for the enlightened person, just as that wound is slowly healed. And this metaphor is explained a little further in the next verse. Dashama mriti labhena, dashama mriti labh, jato harsho vyana vyatam, jato harsho vrana vyatam, tirodhatte mukti labhaha, tirodhatte mukti labhaha, tata prarabdha dukkitam, tata prarabdha dukkitam. Let me introduce this. Some of you are thinking the enlightened person is stuck with this prarabdha karma. Prarabdha karma means you're still going to smash your toe and suffer pain. You're still going to have health issues, kidney stones. You're still subject to undergoing physical and mental pain as an enlightened person. You see? Then what's the point? What's the point? After enlightenment, I'm still going to get headaches? Yep. Migraines? Yep. Worse? Yep. Then what good is this moksha stuff? What are you selling us here? You're selling us as Vedanta. What are you selling us? What kind of scam is this? All right. This verse addresses this fact really nice. This verse, I think, is brilliant in its simplicity and directness, because it's a fact. When you get enlightened, the pain of the body and mind continues unabated. As long as you have a body and mind, you're subject to pain. That's don't blame blame Ishvara. This is the way God created the cosmos. So what to do? But then, what is the value of moksha then? And here he says very nicely. He says dashama amriti labhena. Labhena, due to the acquisition of amriti, not being dead, for the dashama, for the tenth man. What it means is when the tenth man discovers I'm alive, when the tenth man discovers that no one is dead, when the problem is solved, when the tenth man discovers I am the tenth man, I am alive, there's no problem, then what happens? Jataha harshaha. He becomes happy. Not just happy, he becomes elated. Remember, moments ago, he assumed somebody died. To assume someone close to you is dead is a matter of intense grief. In a moment, that grief is removed and he experiences harsha. Harsha will translate as elation. He experiences elation, having discovered that. Now remember, this is the same fellow who was banging his head. Having banged his head, he probably has not only cuts on his forehead, he probably has a headache as well. So he has a headache, he's got bleeding cuts on his forehead. But tell me, jataha harshaha, when he becomes elated with the discovery that there's no reason for grief, that the person he thought was dead is not dead, so with that harsha, with the elation, Is he very concerned about his headache and cut on the forehead? Does he even feel or notice the headache? He won't even notice the headache. The headache is there. The cut on the forehead is there. But because of his elation, it counts for nothing. And that's what he says, that jataha harshaha, the elation that arises with his discovery that there's that no one is dead, then what happens? Vranavyatam, the disturbance due to the cut and the headache, tirodate, gets covered over, gets forgotten, gets overwhelmed. So the harsha, the elation of knowing the truth, which is what it is. He gained a certain elation in knowing the truth, a truth which led to the end of a wrong conclusion which caused suffering, and that elation then covered over the pain that he experienced from beating his head before. And this is the brilliant metaphor. He says, tata, in the same way, muktilabha, muktilabhas is due to the grammar rules, muktilabha, one who has gained mukti, moksha, one who has discovered his true nature, tata, in the same way, prarabdha duhkitam, and you have to bring that word, tirodhate, applies there as well. In the same way, the person who has gained enlightenment will still suffer pain to the physical body and to the mind, but that pain, which is prarabdha dukkitam, the pain born of prarabdha karma, prarabdha dukkitam, the pain, let me stay with the word pain, the pain born of prarabdha karma is tirodhate. It is covered over by what? By the harsha, this is his language, by the harsha, by the elation. In this case, the elation of knowing you are full and complete and limitless and utterly unaffected by the pain. Let's examine this experience a little bit. What is the jnani's experience of pain? We don't have to talk about your experience of pain. You know it. You are the expert. Each one of us are an expert in knowing what pain feels like, both physical pain and emotional pain. No, I don't think you'll find any Vedanta texts that explain it. Because why do you have to explain anything that's so well known? But let's contrast that with the experience of an enlightened person with regard to pain. You experience a headache, the one with jnana nishtha, established in knowledge, also experiences a headache. Your headache is throbbing and intense. The jnani's headache is throbbing and intense. What is the difference? Huge difference. Huge. First of all, when you have a headache, you want it to go away. In fact, you don't even, not just want it, you demand. This headache has got to go away. The feeling you have is you will not be okay until the headache goes away. Until the headache goes away, this situation is utterly unacceptable to you. The presence of the headache is utterly unacceptable to you. The jnani won't have a shred of that resistance. The jnani has a headache and accepts it as any other part of nature. It's like, We woke up this morning and it was raining. Rain is a fact. So it's raining. So the jnani has a headache. A headache is a fact. Rain is a fact. This chair is a fact. These glasses are a fact. A pounding headache is a fact. Neither desirable or undesirable. Facts are not desirable or undesirable. Facts are facts. It's nature. Nature as it exists according to the laws of nature, according to Ishvara's laws. So if you have a headache, you may feel this headache has to go away. I won't be okay until this headache is gone. The presence of this headache is utterly unacceptable to me. And all of those words are expressions of suffering. We've differentiated several times between pain and suffering. So the pain between you and the enlightened person will be identical. But you will suffer. The enlightened person will have zero suffering. Now, there's a second aspect also that's discussed here. And that is, you might say, okay, but then the pain still hurts. Which is true. So for the jnani, the pain still hurts. Is there anything you can do to minimize the hurt? Well, not exactly what you can do, but suppose, let me try to find a language for this. Suppose hurt is present in your awareness and you know that pain is present in your awareness and you know that pain doesn't affect you at all. Pain is present in your awareness. You know that as consciousness, you are unchanging consciousness which isn't affected by that pain in the slightest manner, and further, that the unchanging consciousness that you are is vast, boundaryless, full, and complete. Notice this doesn't make the pain smaller, but it seems to. You know, if there is, I don't know, here's the metaphor. I don't know if this will work. We'll try it. Suppose your pain is this big and your head is this big. And if this much pain is in this head, your head is filled with pain. But suppose pain is this big and you are boundaryless consciousness. Vast. Making that pain, which is the same size, but that same size pain relative to your head is huge, that same size pain relative to boundaryless consciousness, it is small by comparison, infinitesimal by comparison. So we could say then that the jnani's pain is identical, but their experience of the pain is different. The pain will be the same. It's the same throbbing, whatever it is. The throb is identical. But the jnani's experience of that pain will be shifted dramatically by these two other factors. So we're talking three different factors, we said. First factor is absence of suffering. What is the suffering? This pain is unacceptable to me. That resistance, that rejection, which creates so much tension and frustration. So suffering is gone. Second thing that's gone for the jnani is, well, we'll just make it the two things. The second one I've just talked about is that the pain shrinks relative to the vastness of consciousness. So this shifts the jnani's perspective completely so that the pain, it's not such a big deal anymore. It's experienced, it's felt. It's no more, I should have used this word before, it's not threatening. Generally, we find pain, physical and emotional, we find pain threatening. It threatens our well-being, it threatens our happiness, it threatens our contentment. Vijnani will not be threatened whatsoever by that pain and will be absolutely okay in the presence of that pain. So it's a really nice metaphor that shows even though there is anuvritti of the prarabdha karma, and anuvritti of the pain caused by the prarabdha karma, the physical and emotional pain caused by prarabdha, there is anuvritti. But when you have gained this knowledge, the experience of that pain is radically different. So there's no suffering, and even the experience of the pain itself has shifted very dramatically. Okay, we have one more verse on this topic. Let's see that last verse. Shamayat yaushadhe nayam, shamayat yaushadhe dashamaswam vranam yatha. Bhogena shamayatvaitata, bhogena shamayatvaitata, prarabdham muchyate tata, prarabdham muchyate tata. To introduce this last verse, you might think, wait a minute, the enlightened person now is free from suffering. We just established in the last verse, the enlightened person is not free from pain. The enlightened person is free from suffering, and the enlightened person has a very different experience of pain. Remember, the experience, instead of the pain being huge in comparison to oneself, the pain is now tiny or infinitesimal with regard to oneself. Also, there's no sense of being threatened by that pain in any way whatsoever. That being so, the enlightened person still experiences pain. So then the next natural question is, well, what can the enlightened person do to be finally utterly free from any kind of pain whatsoever? And you know where this discussion is going. So let's see how Vidyaranya Swami answers this. Remember, that's my joke that you've heard me give many times. Everyone wants to be free from pain, free from suffering, free from difficulty. Everyone looks forward to the day when they will finally rest in peace. And that's the honest truth. That is the only time when you will experience the complete absence of pain. And that's basically our topic here. So he says, going back to our dashamaha, you see in the in the second line, yatha dashamaha, just like that tenth man, who, remember, this fellow was beating his head. So swam vranam, the pain, the wound vranam, swam vranam, his own wound, what does he do? Shamayati. He soothes that wound. How does he do that? Aushadhena. Ayam dash, after that word ayam is hanging at the end. Ayam dashmaha. This tenth man. What does he do? Shamayati swamvranam. He soothes his wound. How does he soothe his wound? Aushadhena. With some kind of herb, or I don't know what they had in those days, some kind of herb that they would use to soothe the wound. So yatha, at the end of the second line, just as that tenth man, remember, he's now freed from his suffering because he's been told, you are the tenth man. But he still has a headache and the cut on his forehead. So what does he do? He applies some kind of herb to quell the pain. And this is the metaphor. So what is the metaphor? That aushadha is that which removes pain for the tenth man. What is that? What is it that removes pain for a jivan mukta? Jivan mukta is one who is liberated while alive. This is a trick question. What is it that that removes the experience of pain for Jivan Mukta. To answer the question, we have to first answer, why does the Jivan Mukta experience pain? We just talked about that in the last verse. What is the answer? The enlightened person experiences pain because of the anuvritti of prarabdha karma, which causes pain. So the enlightened person continues to experience pain due to prarabdha. So then if the our tenth man removes his pain by applying this aushadham, this herb, the enlightened person removes his or her pain. How? So the pain is caused by prarabdha karma. So in order to remove the pain, you need to get rid of the prarabdha karma. You following? The pain is caused by prarabdha karma. So in order to remove the pain, you need to get rid of the prarabdha karma. How do you get rid of prarabdha karma? You're doing it right now. It's called bhoga, experience. Every day you live and everything you experience is the exhausting of a little bit of prarabdha karma. So through bhoga, bhoga means experience. Through bhoga, prarabdha karma is exhausted. And when that prarabdha karma is finally completely exhausted, what happens to the pain? You rest in peace. And that's what he says here. So he says in the first half, just as the tenth man soothes the pain from his wound with herbs, in the same way, tata comes at the very end of the verse, tata, in the same way, etat shamayatva, etat, this enlightened person, shamayatva, soothing himself or herself. Soothing himself or herself, what? Prarabdha muchyate, they become freed from prarabdha. They become freed from the prarabdha karma that causes pain. How? Bhogena. By exhausting the prarabdha karmas. By exhausting the prarabdha karmas. So let's reflect on this. This is describing the attitude of an enlightened person. The enlightened person experiences pain. The enlightened person doesn't experience that suffering, but continues to experience pain. The experience of pain is shrunk in scope, but it's still experienced as pain. So what is the enlightened person's attitude towards that pain? This is a complete aside. I was watching a movie about some soldiers in Afghanistan. It was really quite a grim and very accurate depiction. And one of them had stepped on a landmine and had blown his leg off. And they were waiting for a helicopter to come and provide treatment to this. And the medic is there trying to take care of him, but give him some morphine, whatever you can do. He's in tremendous pain. In fact, I think there was an epilogue that said this particular soldier was not responsive to morphine. I guess certain people don't respond to morphine, I guess. I think the epilogue said so. So he was in intense pain, waiting for this helicopter to come. And the morphine wasn't giving him any relief. And he cried out, it hurts so bad, it hurts. And the medic said, there was kind of a really dark humor in this. It was really grim, in fact, disturbingly. But the dark humor was through it. And the medic said, you're still in pain? That's good. It means you're still alive. Not bad. Because if he stopped feeling pain, why would he stop feeling pain? He's dead. That's the attitude of the enlightened person. My head is throbbing. That's good. I'm still alive. The enlightened person has this objectivity that pain is part of the human condition. Remember that one is no longer threatened by that pain. That's the key. If you're threatened by pain, none of this makes any sense. But if you are no longer threatened by that pain, how is it that you're not threatened by the pain? You know that you are the unchanging consciousness that reveals the experience of pain in your mind. I'll say that again. To know that you are the unchanging consciousness, you are the unchanging consciousness that reveals the presence of pain in your mind. Knowing that, there's nothing to be threatened by. It's just a fact, like the chair is a fact, like these glasses are a fact. So the enlightened person has this objective perspective. Okay, the pain is there. I'm still alive. And the enlightened person knows that pain will continue to be present until my prarabdha karmas are exhausted. Just like in the metaphor, the pain is present until you apply the ointment, the herb. In the same way, the pain is present for an enlightened person until the prarabdha is exhausted. Fact. And when the prarabdha is exhausted, the pain comes to an end. And when pain comes to an end at the end of one's life, what happens to Atma? Atma was full and complete before death. Atma is full and complete after death. Atma is not affected. Body and mind are affected by death. Consciousness is not affected at all by death. So, this is the transition from Jivan Mukti to Videha Mukti. Jivan Mukti means freedom while you're alive. Videha Mukti, the condition of freedom when you're no longer alive. Videha means without a body. So with that transition from Videha Mukti, from Jivan Mukti to Videha Mukti, the enlightened person is fine either way. The enlightened person in the presence of the body and mind with associated pain, the enlightened person is okay. And when the body and mind fall, the enlightened person is okay. It really is objectivity, and it makes me reflect. You've heard me make this observation before, that Pujya Swami Dayananda would sometimes make this very radical statement. He says, enlightenment is just objectivity. And people would freak out, just objectivity? But when you really understand what he means by objectivity, objectivity means to see the complete reality of what is without a trace of distortion. And you can see, if the enlightened person sees pain as a fact, sees it as it is without a trace of distortion, that is objectivity, and freedom comes from that objectivity. Okay. That's the end of our topic. We start a new topic in our next class. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha, sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pasyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, Mrityor mahamritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om. That's not good. Before you go, I'll remind you that we're celebrating Ram Navami on Saturday. Please come join us, 11 o'clock.